At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
It's The Wonky Show. Welsh universities have a manifesto out. Can applied lead zenith keep students' skills and science at home? Franchising faces some fresh sunlight because OFS has finally dropped some data. And graduate recruitment. Are the AI robots stealing students' jobs? It's all coming up.
In a political environment where we're being told regularly, you know, you university, show us that you're taking all of these issues seriously and then we'll help you. We do need to be thinking about actually, if some subcontracted and franchise courses look like low quality, then that's just pure ammunition for critics.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to dissect the week's developments, as usual, three excellent guests. In London, Sarah Stevens is Director of Strategy at the Russell Group. Sarah, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, this week I turned 40, so that was a bit of a milestone. I haven't had a chance to do much celebrating yet, but I'm going away for the weekend, which is a bit of an unusual occurrence.
In Stoke Newington, Sarah Cowan is Head of Policy, Higher Education and Research at the British Academy. Sarah, your highlight of the week, please.
I'm in the process of moving house. I have finally started packing up far too many books and realising that this is why we shouldn't have quite so many heavy things in our homes.
Excellent. And in Skelmersdale this week, Debbie McVitie is Editor at Wonky. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, I mean, believe it or not, I also am going away to a hotel with a spa this weekend, but it's not because I've turned 40 that ship has sailed. It's because it's my 9-year wedding anniversary this week.
Oh, lovely. So, good. Now, we start this week with Wales. Debbie, Universities Wales has launched its 2026 Senedd election manifesto. What's in there?
Yep, that's right. Senedd elections coming up next spring. Universities Wales is kind of getting first out of the gate with all the things it wants to see from the incoming government, whoever wins that election. So there's no fewer than three proposed cross-party independent reviews, one for overall university funding and student support, one for degree apprenticeships. So Unis Wales wants to see greater flexibility for unis to design apprenticeships with business, and a third independent commission on higher education participation. There's also stuff in there, as you would expect, about sustainable investment in research, innovation, knowledge exchange, securing funding for regional investment that universities can access, and just general calls for support for the internationalisation of Welsh universities. Now, obviously the goal here is to influence manifestos as much as it is to influence whoever wins the election. I think what's really important, I think, for listeners to understand is that there's really interesting background here, because we're looking at some quite big political upheaval potentially in Wales. Labour has been the largest party in all Senedd elections since 1999, but that looks potentially set to change because currently Plaid Cymru and Reform are pulling well ahead of Labour. So there is a chance that the next Welsh government will be a Plaid-led coalition probably. So in that scenario, what you've got is much more focus on Welsh students receiving money to study in Welsh universities and then staying in Wales and getting jobs, graduate jobs in Wales. And that really does change, I think, the political calculus about where universities position themselves.
Yes. And Debbie, they've got in there, there's this thing about a review that should, I mean, it doesn't quite say what Plaid would say, but it does say it should embrace this set of issues, doesn't it?
I think it's fair to say that there's always in Wales, and you know, you see this in Scotland too, there's a sense among Welsh education providers that one of their kind of roles is about nation building. It's about delivering for Wales. And you get that sort of really quite, that can be a really positive thing. I think one of the things you sometimes see with the more nationalist end of the political spectrum is that sense of, well, you know, we shouldn't be paying money for Welsh students to go to English universities, for example. And you know, how can we stop that from happening? And that sort of tilts that kind of what can be quite a positive agenda into something a bit more protectionist, a bit more, you know, a bit more nationalist.
Yeah, interesting. Now, Sarah S., this Seren network, which sort of supports students in Wales to go to the best university for them, has, it's got quite good numbers actually on students leaving Wales and then going into universities in England, but particularly the Russell Group, it's worth saying. And of course, there's only one member of the Russell Group in Wales.
That's right. And, you know, I think it's important in all of this to think about how you protect choice for students. You know, yes, you know, that there are reasons why you'd want to make sure that you're keeping students in Wales, kind of supporting the economy. There are good kind of pathways through to jobs. But it can also be a good outcome for Welsh students to study elsewhere as well. And I think this is kind of part of a wider issue in terms of the low participation rate in Wales. And we were looking at UCAS data that was published recently that showed that Wales was the only UK nation to see a fall in applications this year. And it's really part of an issue around inequity in access to higher education in Wales. So the BBC reported some data showing Cardiff North, almost half of 18-year-olds go to university, but an area a short drive away, and apologies to Welsh listeners for my pronunciation here, Tor Vine, I think it's called, under a fifth of 18-year-olds go. So there's an issue here in terms of addressing entrenched inequality, in terms of regional disparities in students' backgrounds, that I think does make sense actually to have this kind of wider commission to think about how do you address some of these complex issues. And, you know, Welsh institutions are doing a lot in this space. I know Cardiff has a range of programs to widen access for disadvantaged students. They've got one called Step Up Masterclass that looks at working with PhD students as role models to build knowledge about higher education. And I'm sure there are examples across the wider sector, but it's hard for, as you know, for universities to do this kind of work on their own. And thinking about how you address inequality through the whole education system, I think requires a kind of a wider sort of scope to consider.
Tricky stuff this, Sarah, though, isn't it? Sarah C this time, isn't it? Because, you know, Wales has a comparatively older aging population. Birth rates are a problem right around the UK. So, you know, this is our sort of own version of a brain drain problem for a prospective new government in Wales, isn't it?
It is. And I think this is where we have to remember that we have a UK HE market. So it's understandable that Welsh Student Finance, which is relatively generous, the policymakers are going to want to make sure that investment is bringing back economic and social benefits to Wales. But it's a tricky balance. I mean, the goal of student finance isn't just to fund Welsh students, it's to help Welsh students get the education that's right for them, wherever that is. And yes, hope that they then bring that back to Wales. But the way you do that, I think, is you start designing a system to keep students in Wales and to make that an attractive choice, not one that makes it kind of almost punitive to want to leave Wales temporarily or longer term in order to get the education that they want.
Yeah. But whatever you do, if there's a comparison, you can either frame it as punitive if you, yeah, I mean, very, very, very tricky. Debbie, there's just separately on R&D, there's talk of here fully devolving R&D funds via some sort of Welsh block. Is that practical, likely? I mean, what are the chances of it?
Yeah, I don't know. That's really interesting because I guess the first question you would ask, and I think, you know, Sarah S. should definitely kind of sort of correct me on this one, because this is an area of your greater expertise. But for something like REF, it doesn't make any sense at all because, you know, it's a national exercise that is designed to, you know, allocate funding directly to institutions on the basis of excellence and, you know, the wider the basis of comparison. But if you're looking at things like innovation funding or baskets of money that might be tied to kind of regional development, then I think that makes a lot of sense to devolve. I suppose the only kind of question is does that then leave the university sector as a whole sufficiently sustainable in delivering delivering a kind of critical mass of research that then, you know, industry can draw down on and engage with and is sort of in the right areas and has the right expertise and access to the right kit. So I think that there is a really kind of, you know, prima facie case for doing that, but you've just got to be a bit careful about some of the kind of knock-on impacts potentially.
And presumably, I mean, this is really a kind of subset of the previous issue, which is the kind of scale of this, you know, might make the, you know, devolving research funding, for example, actually genuinely very difficult, Sarah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the debate in Wales kind of on research and innovation funding kind of previously has been really around how do you improve the competitiveness of the Welsh higher education sector to win more funding from UKRI, obviously a UK-based funder where there aren't kind of devolved sort of funding streams within that. But actually, Universities Wales here has focused more on what is in the gift of the Senedd in terms of funding, which is devolved through quality related funds, which are obviously linked to REF performance. But the quantum of that funding is decided in Wales, and equally the Research Wales Innovation Fund, which is the equivalent of HIFE in England. The amount is of that is also set by the Senedd. And I don't think those funds have really kept pace with inflation over recent years. And it's been an issue that's been debated by kind of relevant select committees, and a review of QR has already been called for in the Senedd previously. So it kind of taps into those arguments. And as you say, you know, this is really around how do you build innovation ecosystems in Wales? How do you grow the economy? How do you create highly skilled jobs to make Wales competitive within the kind of the broader UK system? So hopefully it's something that the next Welsh government will choose to prioritise.
Sarah C, I guess the other thing that caught my eye here was, I mean, obviously Wales is a bit further ahead in theory on the whole tertiary thing. And there's a proposal for a lifelong learning allowance in here. What could that look like to avoid what you might regard as some of the teething problems of the LLE?
Well, I guess your point about Wales is further ahead, because we have to look at MEDA as a possible framework for other nations of the UK. Like, is actually having a single regulatory and funding body which can coordinate different parts of the tertiary system, which can think about trade-offs, which can work really closely with universities in Wales, with the Welsh government. You know, there are a lot of positives to having a system like that, particularly if you're thinking about actually what's the right, or what does good look like in terms of the opportunities that are available to different students? And that's not just those 18-year-olds. So a lot of this debate focuses on kind of tuition fees and maintenance support for 18-year-olds and that participation rate. But actually, if we're thinking about economic growth, as you mentioned earlier, you've got to be thinking about mature learners, you've got to be thinking about part-time learners, and actually what are the options on the table for them, not just in HG, but in other parts of the education system as well.
This actually struck me, because if I compare it to, for example, a report that Universities UK and the Association of Colleges put out last week, you know, in anticipation of the post-16 education and skills white paper in England, there was a very deliberate effort to say, let's join together, let's think about what that coordination looks like, let's think about what we collectively need to be able to deliver that. And I think it's an interesting choice, and I'm sure that there's context for this, you know, why Unis Wales decided that it was better to go alone and really kind of come out swinging for the higher education sector specifically in an environment in which the direction of regulatory and sort of funding travel is tertiary. And I don't know whether that sort of suggests that there's that has not been as straightforward, perhaps, as simply just setting up a new organisation and saying we're all tertiary now. That there's, you know, I imagine that there's sort of still quite a lot of politics there about how you think about those sectors and the extent to which they can realistically be integrated at a policy level.
Yes. I guess the other thing, Sarah S., is that I don't know how to put this. Let me think about how to put this, Chris. I guess the other thing, Sarah S., is that, you know, the reality is that fee income, tuition fee income from home students is a really important part of all of this. And of course, in a relatively opaque way, the amount of fee income available to Wales is pretty much set by Treasury rules, which are about per capita equivalents on the amount of fee income that England is getting. You know, this is, you know, annually managed expenditure from the Treasury. That big elephant in the room isn't really, you know, very visible in this report, is it?
No, and I guess there are, you know, there might maybe implications if there's a kind of change in terms of the balance of power after the elections. Obviously, we've got a kind of a Labour government in Wales at the moment. So kind of taking their cue from the Westminster government in terms of the way that the funding system is designed, perhaps is more to be expected. But a change of government, they may feel it's kind of easier to look at sort of redesign. But I think, you know, there are lots of read across here in terms of, you know, wider financial pressures on the sector. And one of the things I thought is really interesting here is that, you know, Wales has actually quite a generous approach in terms of funding student support and maintenance grants. And it's an area maybe where England can kind of learn from Wales. you know, Bridget Phillipson made an announcement at the party conference recently that maintenance grants will be reintroduced. But the kicker for the sector was it will be done by the introduction of an international student levy, which will have really significant impacts in terms of an effective cut to funding and therefore ability to fund teaching, research, widening participation, civic engagement activities for English universities. But the Senate has actually ruled out introducing a fee levy in Wales. So there's something to look at here in terms of, you know, can we have a generous maintenance grant offer for students in England, but fund it in an alternative way as Wales has managed to do?
Yeah, and it feels like that's, you know, relatively unlikely. It feels like no party's going to go into the election promising to introduce that international levy, or at least, you know, even if they did, perhaps they would introduce it at a much lower rate. I guess the other thing that really strikes me, Sarah C, is that, you know, if you've got fairly generous maintenance loans and, you know, a sector crying out for tuition fee increases on that kind of credit card with Her Majesty's Treasury, in order to improve, you know, increase tuition fee income, in order to increase tuition fees, one of the options, I guess, is to reduce the generosity of that maintenance system in different ways. And we saw a little bit of that this year when the Welsh government had to break its promise to raise maintenance funding by the national minimum wage anchor rather than by what it did in the end, which was by RPI inflation. Now, you know, if Wales was really successful in getting, you know, improving its participation rate, that problem gets even worse, doesn't it?
Well, it doesn't. And actually, I think you can read this University of Wales manifesto today as almost as them offering Welsh Government a way out of that, which is rather than have to make that decision between which parts of the system you fund within Wales, whether it's direct to the student or to the university, you work on reducing that amount of your HE expenditure, which is currently leaving Wales. So actually, if you can reduce that, I think it's like £500 million that's going on students studying in other parts of the UK. If you can reduce that, that gives you more money in theory to play with that's going into the system within Wales. And then that allows you, it relieves some of the pressure on your application and your participation rate. I mean, the other thing to think about, yes, they've broken that promise last year. There was also an additional pledge, though, of further £20 million for further HE institutions last year to help with some of the financial difficulties that they're in. Now, that doesn't really scratch the surface of some of the deficits that the institutions are in, but you can see that where Welsh Government is kind of straining against some of the Westminster-centric policies and seeing if it can do things a bit differently based on what it thinks Wales needs.
Good. Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Alistair Robertson, Interim Director of the Queen Mary Academy at Queen Mary University of London. And this week in Monkey, I've been blogging about why universities must build an AI positive culture. Since ChatGPT launched in late 2022, universities moved at pace initially, but progress to embed a coherent strategy has stalled across the sector. However, AI literacy is now an essential skill in the modern workplace, and students are saying that they are leaving university feeling underprepared. AI is reshaping society, and in response, we need to successfully embed AI within our universities, across the breadth of operations of the institution, i.e. education, research and professional practice. I believe that adopting an AI positive culture is critical to success, and in my blog, I outline what I consider are some of the key considerations to nurture this new culture.
Now, next up, franchising. After a few years of wrangling, OFS has finally published sector-level outcomes for students taught under subcontractual arrangements. And the figures don't look great, Sarah.
Sure. Yeah, this is quite a significant move from OFS. So for the first time, we've got this publicly available outcomes data for students studying through subcontractual arrangements. So that's where a university or a college awards the qualification, but much or all of the teaching is delivered by a partner institution. It's an area that's grown really quickly. So we're looking at kind of double the numbers that we had 5 years ago. And until now, there's been very little visibility, I think, on how the students are doing. So in terms of staying on the course, completing their course and progressing into either employment or further study. This new dashboard pulls all that data together. It's a start.
it is quite patchy still. And in most cases, the results aren't actually being reported at the level of the provider. So rather than being kind of being broken down by individual delivery partners. So I think it raises as many questions as it answers, to be honest, about quality. And I do think it's also important to say it lands in a pretty sensitive policy context around value of teaching and value of university. So it's a tricky one to look at.
Yes. Now, this is super tricky, this, Debbie, isn't it? Because, you know, at least in theory, just looking at these numbers, what's happening here is that subcontractual provision is below, at least on full-time first degree undergraduates, OFS's three big headline thresholds on continuation, completion, and progression. Now, I guess, you know, the danger for, you know, what we used to think of as traditional franchising, perhaps to an FE college or a small and specialist, you know, creative arts institution, is that what we've seen in the past few years, which is a big expansion in kind of business provision in the for-profit bit, is dragging everyone else down.
Yes, and I think that the challenge is that it's quite hard to kind of, you know, you can see indicators of some of that, and it's quite hard to just sort of put your finger on a smoking gun that says this provider is not delivering for students consistently across the board. Because what you'll see is that some of these very large franchise delivery providers are working with a number of different institutions. So you then kind of. All kind of challenges arise about kind of what are we comparing to what, but you can see that kind of consistency across the piece. So, for example, you know, sort of 77% of subcontracted students continue their courses into a second year, compared to 88% of full time first degree students in the sector as a whole. You can see 74% of students complete, compared to 87% sector wide, and 57% go on to good outcomes, compared to 71% across the sector. So you do see that sort of consistency of the challenge. And I think, you know, the reason OFS has been chary about publishing this data is because there are challenges around saying this is conclusive and this is comprehensive, and the gathering of the data has clearly been patchy, which is you know, something that really should have been thought about from the get-go, but here we are. And now it's going to be about thinking through what can be done on the basis of the data that we can see in front of us. And specifically, how do we differentiate between provision that is meeting a need, that is perhaps recruiting a particular subset of students or delivering a particularly complex bit of something or other? Can we compare those outcomes in those contexts to the large-scale, generic course provision that is actively targeted less advantaged students? And, you know, Jim, you've obviously written a lot about this. I think you call them landfill colleges, which is probably kind of grounds for suing at a baseline. But, you know, what you sort of see is that these are large private providers. They tend to be more litigious. They tend to be offering kind of courses that have broad appeal, and they tend to be targeting prospective students from very low socioeconomic backgrounds. And they say that they are widening participation, but you need to really drill down into the detail to see that there is often quite poor outcomes and also very, very high profit margins. And that's a sort of phenomenon that the challenge is, I think, isolating that phenomenon within this larger data set.
Yes, this this sort of sandboxing problem, you know, is kind of real here, I think. So, you know, if I think about lots of the kind of big stories on the, I don't know, in the press, or even some of the sort of blogs and regulatory interventions that OFS talks about, often it will say there's a group of providers doing X, or, you know, a group of universities is doing Y. And actually then, you know, quite often parts of the sector, sometimes mission groups, sometimes, you know, others will say, well, why are you keeping me in at lunchtime when I wasn't making the noise this morning? Do you know what I mean? It often feels like the whole sector is being tainted by a group of other figures. But sandboxing this is quite tricky, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And I think you're right. You know, there's a broader sort of risk to the reputation of the sector here, and the headline figures kind of mask that underneath the bonnet, there are lots of different approaches being taken here. And there are kind of good reasons why universities pursue franchise arrangements. I mean, for the Russell Group, we're talking about a really small proportion of the collective student body. I think it's less than 0.5% through franchising arrangements. But there are reasons why you'd pursue this in terms of kind of pathways to widen access. A lot of these kind of traditional franchising arrangements that have been longstanding are collaborative partnerships with the FE sector, which the government says it wants to see more of, and we're expecting that to be a theme in the post-16 white paper. But, you know, where there's cause for concern in terms of really low quality or even cases of fraud, clearly there's a need for regulatory intervention here. The OFS needs to investigate. They need to take robust action. But it's about, you know, how do they target those areas where action needs to be taken without having a kind of knock-on unintended consequence for other arrangements that might have kind of valid reasons for existing.
Sarah C, I mean, it, one of the things about the regulatory framework we've got is that it's private or public agnostic, right? I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're making profit or not. You know, the whole thing here is that, you know, it's all about the outcomes. Now, on the one hand, this is not a great set of outcomes. But then on the other hand, one of the things I was doing this morning before we came on was looking at just the gross profit figure. So, the gross profit figure, forget, you know, before you get to administrative expenses like recruiting the students and, you know, paying the rent to a parent company on a building or paying out dividends, the gross profit figure ought to be telling us what is spent on the education. So first one I looked at this morning, one of the fairly big ones, 72 million in tuition fee income, 59 million in gross profit. I looked at another one, 83 million in tuition fee income, 62 million in gross profit. Now, surely there is at least a theory here that the amount of profit is then related to the poor outcomes, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an angle you can look at. But I think if, regardless of how we all feel about public or private or the messaging that it sends to students, we have to make a decision in the UK about if we have a market system or not. Because if we have a market system, which has been pushed for the last 10 years, you don't then get to say, hang on, I don't like that this market is resulting in profits being made in some places and not in others, or that those profits aren't being spent in a way that I am happy with as a state or as a stakeholder or however it might be. There is a role for us to play in making that really clear to students. So it's not just what degree are you leaving with, what institution is accrediting it. You know, do you understand what part of the system you are partaking in and what the consequences of that might be, as we do with any other kind of business model, industry, consumer choice, however kind of you want to label it, because that's a system that we've currently been told to operate in.
I mean, that's a fair point, Debbie. But I mean, we are dealing with here relatively aggressive, you know, recruitment tactics, often on social media, door to door and so on. A group of students who have, you know, quite low levels of social capital comparatively, if we look at the kind of, you know, the profile of the students being recruited. Is it realistic to run a market that says, well, as long as they've got the information, they can make the choices?
I mean, I don't think so. But again, you know, Sarah's point is completely right. This very much, you know, some of this is filtered through an ideological lens about how you feel about this stuff, right? And you've got to kind of put your policy hat on and think about, okay, what can be done that is sort of, I guess, sufficiently nuanced, because, you know, and you know, this is true in the FE sector as well. And I think there can often be some kind of complicated confounding market factors that are actually caused by private providers. But it is sometimes the case that in certain parts of the country or in certain skills areas or in certain education offers, the provision is sort of able to be provided by the private sector because of the nature of that provision and the nature of that bit of the market and all the rest of it. I don't think that's what we're talking about here, though. I think there is a hell of a lot of really good business provision if that's what students want to take. And it may be that these are students that want to study locally or want to do something. And I think there's something about how does the sort of sector respond to that need and that demand in a way that is better than getting into bed with some providers who are clearly more, you know, they are. I can sort of say this in a journalistic way. They're more interested in profit than in the student experience. We don't know that for sure, but you never know what's going on behind the scenes. But clearly, the kind of margins on this stuff, if you're a validating institution, that should raise an eyebrow, right? You should be asking the question. So there's that element of it. But I think you to then kind of say. So I think, you know, the question then from a policy perspective becomes, how can we better understand the nature of the market here? Because markets aren't just formed by the kind of existence of profit. They're not formed, they're formed by, you know, students wanting to do things and providers being able to offer them. And that, you know, that's the case. Any, you know, whatever your kind of framework is, but we have regulated markets. And then it's about saying, well, what regulatory intervention can support the market to work in a way that is in the best interest of students in this particular bit of the market? And that's where and we're being able to say this is not about level playing field and one rule for everybody. In some cases, this is about saying this is not this bit of the market is problematic, and we need to make interventions that are tailored to that particular bit of the market. I think because that's how you kind of manage that's how you manage a kind of complex system.
I do think as a sector we need to be really alive to that. So you can read this as OFS. Essentially, it's a warning and a signal from OFS. You know, we are watching what's going on. We don't really like it. And actually, if your partners are failing students, then you, as the lead university, will be held responsible. And that's right. That's what universities sign up for. And as a sector, in a political environment where we're being told regularly, you know, you university, show us that you're taking all of these issues seriously, and then we'll help you. We do need to be thinking about actually, if some subcontracted and franchise courses look like low quality, then that's just pure ammunition for critics that we're giving. That's for those who say that universities are chasing volume, not value, that it's low quality, that it's not fair on students. And so we need to be really clear that we're not kind of self-harming our sector by allowing this to go on.
I mean, you say it's a warning shot, Sarah, right? But, you know, this has been going on for a few years now. And, you know, there doesn't seem to have been a lot of regulatory action so far, other than OFS doing the thing that it quite often does, which is says, well, we haven't quite got the right powers. We haven't quite got, you know, the right legislative framework in place. It's like, you know, you've clearly got a bunch of providers here that are making very high profits with outcomes that you say are unacceptably poor. Why aren't we seeing the regulation?
Well, yeah, and maybe that's why the warning shot is the right phrase. This is OFS saying something, which the data still isn't good enough for us to make lots of decisions about. But I think you can read it as OFS showing that it's, or at least trying to show that it's getting on top of subcontracted provision to help preempt some of that criticism that the sector is unaccountable or too loose with quality in some areas. Is it sufficient to make sweeping decisions with? No, but we need the data to improve.
I mean, I think that, and because the problem is, and you know, it is infuriating to see some providers operating that are clearly, you know, this sort of overwhelming evidence base that students are not having a good time and they're not succeeding, and they are getting themselves into debt and spending money on something that is not going to serve them well in the labour market. That is infuriating to see, but it can also be true that it is infuriating, and also that OFS doesn't necessarily have the powers it needs to shut it down. Because we see this, these providers will take the government to court. Never mind OFS. You know, huge amounts of money will be spent, and unless the government and OFS can be confident that the actions it takes will be upholdable under the law, then it doesn't serve anyone any, you know, it doesn't move us forward. So there doesn't, you know, if OFS is saying it doesn't have the right powers, we do need to kind of hear that and add pressure actually from the sector perspective to government to sort that out.
But Sarah S, this takes you back then to DfE, doesn't it? Because over in the FE sector, there are limits on the percentage of students that you subcontract. And when you do, you have to prove that the students you're targeting and the subjects that you're putting on is a kind of genuine need in that area. Now, you know, that feels like it would be a very straightforward photocopy over into the other part of the tertiary sector, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, to come back to Debbie and Sarah's comments as well, I think, you know, some of this points to some of the flaws in the way that the OFS was set up and the original kind of ideology around, you know, encouraging lots of new providers into the market. That Joe Johnson's kind of analogy at the time was, you know, we want more Byron Burgers to come along and challenge the McDonald's of the higher education sector. But it hasn't really kind of panned out like that. And actually, lots of these private providers have
more of a kebab from the chippy, isn't it?
Yeah, on the edge of the sector. You know, they're not part of the regulatory framework. They haven't chosen to register with the OFS. The incentives aren't there. And now they're having to kind of backpedal to address some of these problems that are emerging. So, I mean, I think it's good that, you know, the OFS are looking at, you know, publishing this data, having kind of greater transparency in terms of outcomes for students, and encouraging more franchised partners above a certain threshold, is it 300 students, where they'll be required to register with the OFS. So, I mean, I don't know whether it's that they need more powers or whether it's making sure that the right providers are actually kind of in the tent and they have oversight of them and they understand what's happening. Although to Debbie's point, obviously, if you're dealing with very litigious institutions, then that obviously creates a risk for the OFS in how much it can act.
Hi, it's Mark here from the team, interrupting your podcast to remind you that we are now in the final countdown to the Festival of Higher Education, which is just a few weeks away. In case you've been living under a rock, the festival is the biggest, most exciting, and relentlessly interesting event in HE. Here for ministers, policymakers, wonks of every stripe as they come together for today's sector leadership and tomorrow's future stars. We've got data, we've got debates, we've got analysis, we've got interviews, all focused on the biggest and most thorny problems facing UK higher education today. And of course, we've got fun and hijinks too. Four stages, two amazing days, plus one massive party. There's nothing quite like it. We think it's going to be the biggest and best festival we've ever staged. So big, in fact, I'm going to need a lie down after all this excitement. Yes, the rumours are true. The festival will be taking a break next year, so it's your last chance to be part of something like this for a while. We hope to see you there. That's 11th and 12th of November at the University of London. Discounts are available for wonky subscribers, of course, and you can find out all the details at thefestivalofhe.com.
Now, finally this week, graduate jobs. The Institute of Student Employers is reporting an 8% fall in graduate hiring with another dip forecast, Sarah.
Yes, that's right. So there's a new survey that's been published this week from the Institute of Student Employers, their annual student recruitment survey for 2025. And the key finding really was that the balance between graduate and apprentice hiring is shifting for quite a number of employers. So as you say, graduate hiring's fallen, with apprentice hiring increasing. Because the number of apprentices is still quite low overall, the entry-level job market is still down, but only by around 5%. And these findings are really quite different from some of the other recent reports that we've seen from the likes of Indeed and Adzuna that have found much bigger drops in graduate recruitment. And they've been really widely reported in the press. But the Institute for Student Employers makes the case in their press release for their survey that actually what they've done is more robust because it looks at actual recruitment trends rather than just analysing job boards, which can potentially be misleading. And they've also looked at kind of differences between different employers. So there's sharp declines in hiring for a small number of large employers, but others are seeking to grow their hiring. So a kind of a bit of a mixed picture across the sector, I think.
Well, now, yes. Now, Sarah C., if I play the pin the blame game on the donkey game, there are two people that spring to mind. One is Rachel Reeves and her national insurance hike. And the other is sort of Sam Altman and his friends at OpenAI building robots that take all the jobs. Who's in the frame here?
I mean, I think the important part actually of the findings was that you're looking at a third of employers who are actually planning to recruit more graduates. So it really highlights that need to look sectorally, look regionally. I mean, we were talking about Wales earlier. Wales is desperately trying to sort its situation out because it's predicting a need for 40,000 more graduates than it's currently got coming in. So it's just not that simple to say, you know, graduate employment is down across the board, across the UK, and it's all because of this one thing. Economies are so fickle and sensitive to changes. You have to look at everything that's changing and think about the different levers that you want to pull there.
But Debbie, I mean, I often come back to this, don't I? I'm reminded, I think, to try and reconcile all of this, of this Resolution Foundation report that came out a year before the election, part authored, of course, by Torsten Bell, now in the middle of the Treasury preparing the budget, that broadly concluded that we do need more graduates, just not where they are now and not studying what they are now.
I mean, that's the thing that people sort of will be looking to the post-16 education and skills white paper to speak to. But, and I think, you know, you've always got to kind of caveat stuff, and the Institute of Student Employers tends to work with the kind of the large graduate recruiter employers. But there's something about, there's questions here about the perhaps more specific areas or particular needs in particular parts of the country where it would be helpful to have more provision and kind of what you do about that. And that's something that I think is kind of exercising the brains in DfE and hopefully will kind of be something that shows up when the white paper comes out. And you know, and it's something we should all be kind of be thinking about, because you know, you want that you want that consistent return. But yeah, that core point about, you know, we're going to keep needing graduates and probably more of them, I think it remains the case. And I think that's one of the reasons why the PM said only the other week that what we're looking for is a sort of, is we want sort of broad base of opportunity, but with, you know, at least 2/3 of young people progressing into higher level learning. And that's, you know, that's exactly the right direction of travel. Challenge then becomes, well, you know, can we make sure that that's consistent, that it's in the right subject areas, that it's addressing the kind of skills needs of the country and all the rest of it.
Sorry, does that not strike a tension between broad base of opportunity, but only in the things that we want you to study?
I'm sort of deep in the weeds on this because I'm trying to write a paper on it right now. Because I think you can say, right, what we just need is graduate level skills. And then if we have nice broad-based subjects that are, you know, academically generic, but cognitively challenging, then what you get is lots of graduates with skills that are applicable in lots of contexts. That remains true, but there might be a limit to that, I think. And also, it is also, I think, the case that expansion of broad-based generic offerings doesn't necessarily meet the needs of the bit of the population that you would really like to see getting the kind of training and education at that higher level. So that's why we have apprenticeships, we've got technical and vocational education, you know, alternatives. I say alternatives with rabbit ears. The challenge, I think, is that those things are hard to grow because they are often very specialist. It is much easier to grow academic provision. And so that's sort of what that is, and it's much easier, it has been hitherto much easier to draw down funding for it. So there's that. But I don't think that what happens is that in that kind of microcosm of the graduate job market in any given year, you see these things playing out. These things play out at kind of a macro level, at the kind of trend level. And it's the graduate labour market becomes this sort of weird kind of lightning rod for anxiety about the future of skills, the future of higher education, the value of higher education, what it means to do something that is, you know, coded as vocational training versus something that is academic. And we know that these things are so kind of, have so much kind of cultural weight on them that you can sort of barely talk about them without immediately falling into kind of mad generalizations.
I mean, Sarah S., the other thing that strikes me here is that the sort of traditional defense of traditional academic education and graduateness and graduate skills and so on, you know, arguably this is a kind of industrial revolution that is starting to challenge that demand for that set of skills. You know, someone put it to me a few weeks ago as graduate recruiters in an information economy used to be very interested in production of, you know, analysis and reports and so on. And he's now starting to become more interested in performance, communication and, you know, talking to people and listening and so on and so on. And that presents a real challenge to traditional academic education and what it sort of produces, doesn't it?
Well, I think to come back to your point on AI as well and how that might be affecting the job market, I think some of this has kind of been overblown in terms of the reporting, particularly around, you know, the press talking about kind of entry-level graduate roles disappearing to automation. I think the Institute for Student Employers work kind of shows that that's not really happening at the moment. But absolutely agree. I think universities do need to be considering how they prepare graduates for a more turbulent labour market in future, particularly thinking about kind of using AI as a tool in the workplace, but also embedding kind of broader based skills in terms of kind of career readiness. We published some principles on the use of AI in education a couple of years ago, which looked at kind of how do you promote AI literacy? How do you give students kind of hands-on experience to use AI tools across different modules? And they've been quite kind of widely applied across our institutions and across the sector. So I think, you know, there will be more of a focus on this and on kind of how you encourage kind of entrepreneurship, how you work more closely with employers to provide kind of internships and things like that. It's obviously of interest to the government, and expecting to see that as a theme coming through in the post-16 skills paper as well. But it's got to be kind of matched by the right incentives, I think, in terms of if we want a kind of more flexible offer for students, if we want to be able to offer kind of better lifelong learning opportunities, the right kind of policy models need to be introduced to kind of support that shift in the sector.
I mean, I want to come in on AI because I think this is absolutely fascinating, because it absolutely, very clearly, is disrupting the graduate job market, but absolutely not in the way that everyone's saying it is. And I think Charlie Ball, who is, you know, obviously the person that you go to for anything graduate job market, has got a great piece out on the Prospects Illuminate blog. He's sort of saying that what AI has done, it has lowered the bar to putting in an adequate application. So lots and lots of, you know, if you're a graduate, you might not have a lot of experience of making job applications. AI can absolutely help you deliver a decent quality application. The problem, and you can do that for many, many more jobs. So what has become impossible for employers is to distinguish between, you know, the decent candidate and the excellent candidate, and do any of that kind of real matching about who are the right people for us. And so in an employment, in a labor market where the kind of employer tactic was to spread the net as widely as possible to try and kind of get the best talent, employers are saying, actually, this is costing us too much. It's costing us too much to recruit because we're having to kind of sift through very competent applications. And one of the things they're sort of thinking about doing is saying, how do we narrow the pool? How do we become more targeted? That changes the calculus of how you apply for a graduate job. And that needs to kind of filter through, I think, into careers advisors in universities and thinking about that, because simply producing a good quality application isn't going to be the thing that's going to get you the job so much. I think it also speaks to the application process needing to change in some way. In the same way as universities are thinking about how do we make our assessments more authentic, how do we create context in which AI is either supplementary or is itself part of the process, and we can kind of judge how that works kind of in real time. That's going to filter into the jobs market, but it's going to take a little while. And so then it is therefore not surprising that you get these stories of graduates saying, I've applied for 200 jobs and nary a nibble, because it's really hard for employers to figure out who's actually right for the job and pull in the right people to interview. And you know, that I think is a story that is really worth kind of focusing on and thinking about a lot more.
Well, but I think to Debbie's point, you're looking at people all with similar qualifications who are then...
Well, there you go. Exactly. So do we need, you know, more differentiation, say in, I don't know, degree transcripts as we see in other countries, rather than just lumping everyone into a, you know, you've got a 2-2 in a moderately generic academic. So, do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. But I think you're looking at reversing sort of 15, 20 years of employers trying to do the opposite, which is not look at real specifics around qualifications, because in order to widen that net, as Debbie said, so we've seen a lot of movement of people trying to move away from, you know, so-and-so, this kind of person has this kind of degree from this kind of institution. I should broaden my mind. I should think differently about the kind of employees that I want in my industry. I think that's what AI is disrupting, rather than disrupting the nature of the jobs that are being performed.
But I mean, you know, Sarah S., in the end, in a mass system, students and institutions over time, notwithstanding the debate about, you know, grade inflation, are going to gravitate towards, you know, reaching a level, aren't they, in types of qualification, unless the sector is able to better describe what a graduate knows and can do. There's a real problem here, isn't there, in the interface then between the qualification system and employers?
Well, I think that's where it's useful to have more kind of employer engagement, actually, in kind of setting curriculum, offering kind of internships. You know, other models like degree apprenticeships are really interesting. And, you know, I think the sector's kind of really lent into that. Out of our membership, I think that the majority are offering degree apprenticeships. But actually, we're kind of seeing a move from the government to look at kind of lower level, more innovation at kind of lower levels, and encouraging the apprenticeship spend to focus on kind of young people who are at risk of not being in work or training. There were cuts to level 7 degree apprenticeships. So I think that to the point I made earlier, kind of that there's an issue here in terms of how do we have the right incentives for institutions to really look at being innovative with different types of qualifications, with working more closely with employers to offer that sort of differentiation and the kind of experiences that really help graduates once they get into the job market. And arguably, I think that the government needs to be doing more here.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if HE Chat is your bag, don't forget that the final few tickets are on sale for our Festival of Higher Education in London on the 11th and 12th of November. Just visit wonky.com for details. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Sarah, Debbie, Michael Salmon for making it all happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.